Hafide, welcome to another episode of Hearthstone Deck Tech, where we talk about different archetypes in the game and get some interviews with some notable players and casters in the Hearthstone scene. I just came back from my vacation in Japan. I know we missed last week's episode, but we have a special guest today. So, and this is the first time we've had a guest of this type. We've never had a caster, a Hearthstone, professional Hearthstone caster. And we have one today who also happens to be a really good Hearthstone player, has hit rank one legend just this past week as well. So, Gia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Gia, you are a professional Hearthstone caster, a very good Hearthstone player. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got started in the game?
Right. So I was actually one of those grassroots people that started by attending Fireside Gatherings. There used to be a board game cafe near my university that I would go to every Sunday because they would hold these little tournaments, about 12 to 20 people every week. And it was just our little group, but we would be really consistent about it. And I got a taste of competition through there. And then at one point, the owner of the board game cafe wanted to have a bigger tournament that would be streamed. And he asked if I wanted to cast it. And I said, sure, why not? And through that event, I met people that worked at Mineski and ESL Southeast Asia at the time and worked a couple more local events. And then they recommended me to Blizzard Southeast Asia because at the time they were lacking local English-speaking talent. Mm-hmm. And so I call it RNG basically, but being at the right place at the right time and them enjoying my work, I got to do the Hearthstone Malaysia major in December 2016. And ever since then, I've just been doing more and more events in Asia Pacific and eventually got to work the playoffs and then 2 weeks of GM.
Awesome. Amazing. So when you started doing all this casting stuff, were you already a very good Hearthstone player? I mean, had you hit Legend already? Were you already in the top 100 at that point?
Yeah, I was definitely, the first time I hit Legend was like 2015. I don't know when I first got like top 100 or so, but I'm pretty sure I had hit it by that point. Like I was decent at the game, like nowhere near my level right now, but I think that I was definitely at a good enough level to cast. And that's a big part of why I kept getting hired back, I think, is because people liked my analysis.
Did you, I'm not familiar with the casting scene in the Philippines. Like, are there any other notable casters that people should look out for or maybe listen to that are from the Philippines? Or are you just the most notable?
Not to flex, but I do think I'm the most notable Hearthstone caster, at least English speaking for the Philippines, mm-hmm. because we don't really have a lot of talent that goes abroad mm-hmm. to work the more visible events. But we have like a healthy, like local competitive scene where they're always fielding new people. And I have a friend, Riku. She does way many other games than Hearthstone, but she did Hearthstone at the, WESG Southeast Asia qualifiers or finals last year. And she's been doing a little bit of Hearthstone overseas too. So she's one to watch out for.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. You know, honestly, I really like that. Like your commentary is not like this. Okay. But typical Filipino commentary can get so bogacious. I love it. I love it.
Okay, it depends on the game, though.
Like Dota, okay? Like, oh my God. So Dota, like you can, there's a voice chat wheel, right? And then like you can upgrade your account, you get the chat wheel, you can get like the Russian chat wheel or the Chinese chat wheel. The best chat wheel is by far the Tagalog chat wheel. It's just like so hilarious. It's so great. Normaline. What does Normaline mean? Do you know what Normaline means?
I don't even play Dota, but then I guess like when you add in to the end of a verb, right, you have to make it normal. So in the Normaline mo. I don't know.
Oh my God.
I speak Filipino, but I don't speak Dota. That's a problem.
There you go.
But I know it's a big meme in the community.
It's so ridiculous. I love it. I love it. I think it's the greatest thing. Yeah. Even my local scene here, like for other games, the people with the of Filipino descent. They always have the best commentary. It's just like an inside joke between them, like a brotherhood, like, you know, and I love it. It's just, it's so hype. But anyway.
Yeah. I think it works really well for Dota, but I don't know how to quite translate that to Hearthstone. Because there's not much you can really shout at in Hearthstone. And then it's like they're super entertaining and I really respect that type of work, but I just don't think it would be quite apt for Hearthstone.
Definitely not. Hearthstone, the action is a lot slower. But that said, your commentary is always very insightful and like you put a lot of forethought.
Thank you.
And like really, you are a great player. 100%. You are like really an amazing Hearthstone player.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
No, that is truth. That is fact, guys. If you don't follow Gia, follow her on Twitter. It's at Gia D underscore, right? There's an underscore there.
Gia underscore D was taken. Unlucky.
Yeah, who did that? I wonder who that person is, but that is... Like, you're honestly just an incredible Hearthstone player. And I was looking at your Wikipedia just to see, like, you know, your earnings in the game over the past, like, year. And, I mean, man, you're, like, $33,000. Like...
Well, that was from one organizer. WESOE was, like, a really lucky break for me. But, I mean, I'll take it.
Right? You know, I even watched, like, some teaser video where, like, the guy is making the necklace. He's like building the necklace and all the holy cow, this is awesome. That is like, man, that is esports right there. That is awesome.
Yeah, that company, they're really up and coming. I think they're now going under eSports or something like that. eStars Studios. They produce a tournament series called WSOE. It's been going on for 6 events already. The 7th one is coming up this month, and they do all sorts of different games. But they did Hearthstone twice, and the Hearthstone one was an all-female invitational, so I ended up winning the first one, which gave me a huge advantage in the second one because I only had to play one set.
Wow.
And because they have this whole title defense type thing, which was kind of weird, honestly, from a Hearthstone perspective, but their whole branding is about hype and treating this as, like, top-level competition, which it is when you brand it that way.
It sure is.
And, so I owe them a lot, honestly, because without that kind of opportunity, I don't think I would have been able to establish myself as a player so much. And that's nothing wrong with that. Like, I'm fine being labeled as a caster, but I really like that people get to see both sides of my work.
Definitely. Before we get into more of the issues and details about casting, maybe you can talk a little bit about your most recent experience as a player, I guess at a competitive level. I know you did, you made the qualifier for the GM, right? Like through Vegas?
Not GM, for a Masters Tour, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you did the Vegas, you made top 4 there, right? And then...
I did. Oh, the qualifier. Yeah. So there's 2 types of qualifiers, right, for the Masters Tour. There's one that is winning an open. They changed it to top 2, but at the time it was either you win an open or you finish top 200 and ladder, and then you play a tournament for those 200 people, and then the top 4 of the ladder tournament get to qualify. So I did the ladder tournament, and I top 4'd that one. So that's how I got to go to Vegas as a competitor.
And that was also specialist format, right?
It was, yes.
Do you like specialist as a format?
Next question. No, I'm kidding. Okay, so it's not as bad as I thought it would be when I first heard about it, because I thought, oh my God, we're only going to see the same deck every single week, right? Because why would you bring anything but the strongest deck? But then after talking with players and doing my own prep about how to build lineups, there's actually quite a deep level of thinking that goes into it. But from a viewer perspective, I think it's just not that great, because even though it's not just 3 decks, maybe you see a couple of other paladin coming out. Yeah, archetypes, like the Holy Wrath paladin, Pogo Rogue. It's very niche, right? So for the most part, you're going to be seeing the same decks. And I feel like what makes Hearthstone very entertaining is that you play multiple classes. And I just want to see that more as a viewer. And as a caster, I feel like there's way more to talk about when you do lineup building based on different decks instead of just 2 or 3 tech cards.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. On that note, what do you think about the Grandmasters? Yeah, I don't want to ask you too many questions like this, because I know you're a caster and I want you to be able to give an unbiased answer. But you know, what do you think about the Grandmaster setup anyway? Like how it's limited to these 48 players and the criteria. I mean, you know, it's kind of right. weird just because like they were picked before the criteria was ever released. So that one's kind of, it's just tricky, right? You know, but.
Yeah, this is a whole can of worms to open up. But as concisely as possible, I can say that the idea of GM, I think, is a positive thing for Hearthstone, because last year we had this saturation of tournaments where from a viewer perspective, you're seeing new names every week or so. And you're like, who do I follow? Who do I root for? It's just too many. Right. With GM, you can prop up the biggest personalities of Hearthstone and really create a brand for them and have these ambassadors for the game, which I think is a positive thing. But what I don't like is that it is basically GM and then three Masters Tours. That's the only way you get visibility as somebody that isn't GM. So I feel like if GM were done at a time when either playing at more tour stops was more viable, or if you could actually make it to GM this year without being mm-hmm. invited prior, that would be much better. So like, I just wish that GM was not a replacement for HCT, but rather it was something done on top of HCT.
Let's talk a little bit about casting. Like, mm-hmm. I've never casted something of that scale. Like, how challenging, what are the biggest challenges with casting? Like, what do you think are the biggest challenges?
The biggest challenge. So, for me, my biggest challenge is being entertaining, because I think about the game a lot and I have a lot of insight. Every single play I look at, I think of many things I want to analyze, and I think I'm pretty good at communicating that type of thought process. But I struggle with being hype at the right time, with emphasizing when something really important is happening. And that's why I really admire people like Admirable, haha, no pun intended, who are able to inject way more of the excitement into the game. And then there's TJ, who has like this humor and this ability to gel with anybody he's talking to. Mm-hmm. Personally, I have a more difficult time with the banter part of casting and kind of just joking around with my partner and make it seem like we're just having a conversation as two friends, right? I feel like I'm a little bit too formal. That's my biggest challenge. But I understand that for many other people, there's many other different things to worry about. Like, some people are just not confident with talking for long periods of time. It's very tiring. Mm-hmm. There are some people that cannot put their complex thoughts into words more easily. And then there are people that have a hard time wording themselves diplomatically, which is also a difficult thing for casting. And there's a whole lot of other things.
So typically when you do these tournaments, does Blizzard or whoever the organizer of these tournaments, do they break you down into one of you guys is like the color commentary and one of you guys is more of the play-by-play, like a detail commentator?
Right. When I would say that for GM, it's definitely been paired up that way consciously. But as of the tour stops last year, sometimes it's hard to get talent at all to fly out to this place halfway across the globe on such short notice. So that wasn't always in place. But I do think they're doing that more consciously now, where you have one analyst and one host. And I'm almost always in the analyst role, but I've tried some hosting, which I think I'm decent, but nowhere near as good as I am as an analyst.
So, you know, I know, like, there are always two criticisms that I always see, like, on social media when it comes to these larger scale esports events and the play. And it's usually that players misplay a lot, especially in the in the GM. Like, there have been a bunch of people who misplayed, you know, which is going to happen, right? That's how people win or lose.
For sure.
And that casters either are too critical. Either casters don't see the best lineup play, or that they criticize a lineup play that doesn't look like the best lineup play, but maybe is the best lineup play. And I know that this is a point of contention because it's happened a lot, right? I mean, what do you think about?
I actually tweeted a long set of notes on this, actually. Because I've been on both ends of that. But the funny thing to note, I think Sottle tweeted about this, is that earlier on in Hearthstone, casters were criticized for being too soft on the players. Like, we wouldn't take hardline stances, we wouldn't call out misplays directly. But nowadays, the GMs are, I guess, I wouldn't say sensitive, but more conscious of how they're represented. Because, I mean, it's my belief that reputation does matter, because that's how you get selected for GM in the first place, is you have a following, you're respected by the community, and Blizzard thinks you're a good rep for them. So if you are misrepresented as looking like you made a bad play, even though you made the best play, it's fair to be upset by it. Sure. Especially if you're somebody that is not that well established, because there are some GM players that are newer to the viewers than others who, to certain viewers, can do no wrong. So yeah. I think that's a thing that casters and players should be conscious about. But the way that people have been calling each other out on Twitter sometimes just seems like way too much for me. Like, the players, when they got salty, I'm not going to name names, but there were some tweets that just seemed like they were assuming the caster was actually trying to make them look bad, which is never what we tried to do. Never. Yep. It's just an honest mistake on the caster's part. And I feel like it should be common knowledge to every viewer and every player and every caster that what the caster is saying is not the word of God. We're never 100% correct. We're also just trying to give our own opinions on the play. And that is subject to our own knowledge, which won't be perfect. And it obviously won't be on the same level as the GMs. But the thing is, sometimes the viewers are a little bit too results oriented, or they hold a caster's word as being true. It's just like, it's really weird, right? Because some, like, the most popular meme for casters is sap casters, right? We suck at the game, blah, blah, blah. But then sometimes when we call out a play with caster vision, they're like, yeah, of course you make that play. Why is the player, you know, not doing the obviously correct thing? And then it makes them bad, right? So it's really difficult to cast while being impartial, I would say.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's certainly a thing. And I think, I mean, you know, I don't want to put anyone on the spot or anything, but, like, I know that it's difficult to be a female and be involved in the Hearthstone scene, especially at that level. How many female players are in the Grandmasters right now? Is there only one?
One. It's Pathra. That's it? That's it.
So, like, you know, even her situation, like, because she's under such a microscope, she's the only female player, like, Twitch viewers are ready to call her out on every single play, whether it's the right play or the wrong play. And I think that makes your job way harder, like, simply because, like you said, you got to make a decision on the spot on whether or not you thought that play was correct or if there was a better line of play. And I think the semantics, wording, can get you in trouble or not, you know? And I think it's a difficult job, definitely. It's a tough job.
Well,
so,
as a caster, I try to just, like, regardless of a player's identity, I just try to give my honest opinion every time. With Patra's case, obviously, she has gotten way more criticism than other players, despite her result being just one more loss than the next worst performing player in GM. And I think that's really unfair. But I am not going to sugarcoat any type of opinion I have on any player as a caster. I feel like that's my duty. I'm not actively thinking about, should I be, like, less critical of this player's place? Like, it would be the same if we had, say, a representative that was transgender or a representative that was physically handicapped of some sort. Like,
for sure.
It's like, they're just playing in that moment. So if I think it's correct, I'm going to say so. If I think they got unlucky or they did something incorrect, I'm going to say so as well. With Patra, though, it's the same, but I also have this personal relationship with her. I talk to her a lot about it because I'm the only woman that's cast GM so far, and she's the only woman that's been playing GM. And she's gotten so much harsh criticism, and I try to be there for her.
Of course.
At the same time, when I'm on the desk, though, I'm not going to be biased at all. And if we're going to open up this conversation about what it's like to be a woman in Hearthstone, I think that's a whole other separate thing from, is it difficult to choose your words carefully?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, and I don't, We can get into that discussion. I don't like we don't have to. I don't really want to turn it into that type of discussion simply because I feel like, you know, maybe it's not the right platform to get that type of exposure.
But I don't mind that. I treat this as an AMA.
Let's talk about how difficult is it to be a female and play competitive Hearthstone or cast.
So I can talk about my experience. I understand it's probably much different for other women in the scene. For me, it's been both positives and negatives, but I actually think that the positives have outweighed the negatives for me, which is not something that most women can say. I've been really lucky, honestly. I think that I often think about when I got my first gigs casting, did somebody look at my application? I didn't really apply on paper, but did they look at me as a potential caster, as someone with value added because I have representation of a minority? I will never know, but I genuinely believe that after my first few opportunities, I kept getting hired back purely because I am talented at casting.
Oh, that's 100% the truth. 100%.
And then when we talk about what are the other benefits, like, obviously, I wouldn't have gotten invited to WSOE if I was not a woman. I wouldn't have made that amount of money. And more importantly, I wouldn't have gotten the opportunity to establish myself as a competitor if I was not a woman. So, I mean, I would say that's a huge positive as well. The negatives that I've experienced, I feel like every woman has experienced, which is just like whenever you go on stream, there will always be a handful or more people on Twitch chat that will assume you're only there because you're a woman. Mm-hmm. They're going to assume you're clueless about the game or you're there just to fill a quota. That's always annoying. But in terms of just like, you know, having toxic viewers say things about you, that, I mean, you could make the argument that, yeah, Twitch chat does that to everyone. I don't think that's a good argument to say why we should tolerate it. But I don't think I've gotten the same amount of verbal abuse as many other women in the scene. And I'm like not really qualified to talk about the most difficult aspects of it, I think, because, but I will say that it seems like when you're a woman, people really care more about what you look like than it would compared to when they're watching a guy play. That's just the truth.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. You know, like when I think about, so one of my questions that I wanted to ask you was like, what players are you surprised, did you think should have made season one of the GM and that you're surprised not to see? And I want to ask you that question, but I also want to ask you if you thought there was a female player that should have been, on the representative.
It's a really tough question. I don't think we can get into this without discussing what GM is meant to be in the first place. Because my big problem with it is that the way it's touted is that it's the 48 best players in the world, top players, purely merit-based, blah, 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 right? But then when they go into the criteria, they talk about how some of the slots are given for community contributions. Yeah. So those two are already at a disparity, right? So I think that what people need to understand is that like the top 48 best players is just like Blizzard is going to label it that way, but ultimately it's the people who they think will represent their game the best.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so if we're talking about being in there based on merit, I was really surprised to not see Language Hacker there, to not see Ike, to not see A8 numbers, the European player, basically everybody at Worlds who didn't make it. That to me was a big shocker. I was also shocked that Oskaka and Sixo were not invited, or rather Oskaka was invited, I think, but that's another story. In terms of, if I think about it aside from the merit-based thing, and if I think about it, did they have an opportunity to have better representation for their game, then I could have stood to see more female players. I also could have stood to see more transgender players, to see people of different races aside from, like, well, I don't think we've seen a single African-American player at GM. That's if they want to look at it as, you know, trying to be as diverse as possible. They could have included players with physical disabilities and things like that. So it's a really difficult question to answer if you're thinking about, if you're thinking of GM as like, what is the best way to represent the Hearthstone fan base? Because that is something I can't do by myself. Mm-hmm. Blizzard has data on their viewers. They have analytics on the type of people that actually play Hearthstone. And maybe they decided one woman out of 48 is accurate representation. I would not know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'll just say that based on merit, I would is really surprised not to see the world's players there.
Yeah, for sure. So we touch upon some of the GM, some of those spots are reserved for like, I don't even know what you would classify them, but as content creators that are like Strifecrow, right? Like he didn't get in through his...
I think he was in through the prize money earnings, the community contributors.
Oh, okay, community contributors. I'm sorry.
Yeah, those are the legend spots. So yeah. for Americas, that was Zalay and Nalgidan, if I'm not mistaken.
So there's not any community contributor that you are, I mean, I get not surprised, but kind of just wish, we're hopeful that maybe made it in?
Well, I think that in terms of selecting community contributors that have also had competitive achievements, I mm-hmm. think that they did all six of them are qualified based on that, because they could have selected someone like Krip, for example, who hasn't competed in years, but obviously he's one of the biggest content creators.
Yeah.
Someone like Toast, but they did not do that. So I feel like that's still a nod to not being completely sellout. No offense to Krip or Toast, right? But this is still meant to be like, to some degree, the top players of Hearthstone. So I think that their choices of community contributors were pretty decent. I do wish that there were more slots, though, because there are other community contributors that also would meet those criteria.
Oh, yeah. IF48 doesn't even begin to touch the surface of like the amount of good, not just players, but even content creators that are out there in the game and contributors to the Hearthstone community.
Absolutely.
Let's move on a little bit. That conversation is getting too too serious. I want to talk more about Hearthstone. So
okay, all right.
You know, I know you hit Legend first in like 2015. Did you think there was a huge barrier between hitting it, like when you first hit it, like were you at a wall? Did something click in your head, or were you just naturally,
I had a lot of self-made barriers. Like I was free to play for the longest time until like right before WSOE, which was like end of 2018. The most I had spent on Hearthstone was $15, and that's it.
Wow.
So like I took so long to hit Legend because I was insistent on playing homebrew crappy Warlock decks with like Drain Life and things like that. I don't even remember like spell damage Warlock. That's what I wanted to play. When I started college, I had this one classmate who was actually Legend in Hearthstone. And to me, that was like, damn, you're so good at the game. I thought it was this huge, huge achievement. No offense to the people that hadn't hit Legend yet. But I asked him for help and he told me, girl, just build a zoo deck and play that. So we built a zoo. He helped me reach some of the higher ranks and then I got to Legend eventually. So after I hit that, it was like such a big achievement. I remember how giddy I was. And I miss those days.
Now that you hit it, like now
it was a simpler time. It was a simpler time.
I know now you just hit like rank one Legend and you're just like, oh gosh, it's such a chore, right? I mean, I guess. Rank one. That's so wild.
It's not really a chore. Like it's a grind for sure, but I mean, I wouldn't be trying to hit rank one Legend if I didn't still enjoy the game and enjoy competition, right? Because ladder doesn't really count towards anything except trying to get to the qualifiers right now. But I still want like to be able to prove that I can do the game well, because it's not like hitting rank one is like extremely easy right now. It may not be as hard as it would be during a competitive season, but it still took hours and hours. Like there's still streamers like Bloodyface, for example, he just tweeted he hit rank one after streaming for 16 hours and days before that. So it's still a respectable achievement. So I, like, that's why I tried to get it.
What do you think are the hardest, or like the biggest, maybe not biggest obstacles or principles that you had to learn to go from just hitting legend to, you know, I being rank one, or to being used to competing for the top 100 spots on a consistent basis?
So the number one is focus, because it's super easy and common for players to just like be laddering while multitasking. For me, I would be watching streams while playing, or maybe watching TV shows even. Mm-hmm. And right now I was doing a lot of Duolingo Chinese while trying to hit legend, but that does not help your win rate at all. Like towards the higher ranks, I had to dedicate all of my focus onto the game. I have the deck tracker up. It helps a lot, unless you have perfect memory and all of that.
Yep.
And just try not to burn yourself out, because I have this bad habit of when I hit a losing streak, I tilt, but it makes me want to win more just to break the losing streak, but yeah. I end up losing more, right? So you should be able to stop yourself when you know that you're playing badly because of the tilt. Just, you know, it'll still be there tomorrow. There's no more point to finishing and all of that. So you can go for it the next day.
Do you have like, right? A hard rule?
And when you are better rested.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead. You can.
I think that another thing I do is switching decks too often, but this works for some people. But for me, I generally perform better when I just stick on the one deck, because you get more experience on it and you just get in that mindset better. But it's very tempting to switch decks after you lose a lot with one, because, you know, you feel like you're only getting bad matchups and all of that. But I would recommend staying to one deck if you had some amount of success with it, even though at some point you hit a losing streak. You're probably going to be a second.
Okay. So you brought this mid-range hunter list. And for those of you at home who cannot see the video, or you're not watching this on YouTube, it's a 2 Shimmerfly, 2 Springpaw, 2 Timberwolves, 1 Tracking, 1 Headhunter's Hatchet, 2 Scavenging Hyenas, 2 Scale Hides, 2 Animal Companions, 2 Deadly Shots, 2 Kill Commands, 2 Master's Call, 2 Unleash the Hounds, 2 Dire Frenzies, 2 Marked Shots, 1 Tundra Rhino.
2 Marked Shots, 1 Tundra Rhino, 2 Unleash the Beast,
and
Zul'jin. I remember the bottom.
So, you know what? I am making a big revelation here that I haven't really done. And, like, Hunter and Shaman are my least played classes. I rarely ever play Hunter, because in beta, I had the most horrible experience with Hunter. Unleash the Hounds was so ridiculous in beta.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. I hate it. Like, Hunter, I have, like, you know, I have a picture of Rexxar, I'm like, right above my bed, and every night, like, I punch it, you know? But no, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. But, you know, Hunter, like, I just don't play it a lot. So you sent me the deck list a couple days ago. I saw it on your Twitter. And I was like, you know what? Before I get G on the stream, I better play the deck a bit, get the feel for it. You know, I'm a pretty good Hearthstone player. I'm, you know, I'm not too shabby. This is cool. We gotta go level with it. So I played it yesterday, and I was like, you know what? I'm just gonna get 5 wins. I got like a little 5 win quest. Let me just play till I get 5 wins. So let me just tell you, I went like 2-7. 2 wins, 7 losses. I couldn't believe it.
No.
I couldn't. And this is not like legend. This is not rank 3. This is like rank 9, rank 8. You know what I mean? And I know it's I'm playing the deck bad. So I do have a lot of questions that I want to ask you. The first off being, why did you choose this deck? And like, what types of decks did you want to face? And what didn't you want to face?
So, people debate about this, but I think Hunter is favored mage, which was like one of the most popular decks on top legend at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit less favored when they're running Frostbolt and stuff, but I just think that, you know, Huffer and Scavenging Hyena are just things that mage cannot deal with easily. And then your hero power is insanely good against mage.
Yep.
Because they have one source of healing, Zilliax, and that's it. So mage is the big one. Then Control Warrior, I think that Hunter should be favored against that people are saying it's not against a good Control Warrior player. And by good, I mean if they get Boom Mad Genius on
seven. Yeah,
okay. yeah, it can be a bit harder. So that's why you see people running like augmented Elec these days. But I personally don't really like the Elec. But I do think Hunter's favored in that matchup. It's also not too bad against like Zoo and Token Druid. It like it seems like it would be bad on paper, but Unleash the Hounds is just an insanely good card in those matchups. It will struggle against Rogue though. Tempo Rogue is definitely the hardest matchup.
How about Bomb Warrior? Bomb Warrior is pretty easy or pretty even?
Ooh, I would say that's like not very, it's like very slightly favored. I'd put it maybe 52-53% because you cannot deal with Boom with six bombs on board. It's just really difficult. You need to have exactly Unleash into like removal for Boom itself. But that's a matchup where you can definitely win in fatigue if you do take the game that long. Just because Zul'jin is, if you manage to survive till a good Zul'jin, you should be fine in that matchup. But it's tough. Like at Vegas, I also played mid-range Hunter, and my win rate against Bomb Warrior was not great. I went 2-3, so it's not an amazing matchup for sure. And then there's a lot of aggro Shaman, which I was losing to a lot at the beginning, but I think I figured out how to play the matchup to make it a lot better for the Hunter. I don't know if it's actually favorable for Hunter or maybe the aggro Shamans weren't playing optimally, but towards the end of my Legend run, my win rate was super high against aggro Shaman.
I see. So, like, what is the game plan with this deck? Like, what are you trying to do? Like, what are there like certain combos that you're trying to achieve and push forward? Like, are you always trying to be the aggressor? Are you playing for board? Like,
well, the beauty of it being mid-range is that you can, for a faster game or a control-oriented game plan, against Rogue, most of the time you're playing control. You just want to remove their stuff, you want to Dire Frenzy your Scale Hides and survive until Zul'jin locks them out of the game. Same with aggro Shaman. Against Bomb Warrior, you can play control or you can be aggressive. It depends on your opening hand and how their opening turns line up. Against Control Warrior, I think you're supposed to be the aggressor. And that's why people think the matchup's unfavored, is because they try to outvalue them with their own Zul'jin. But to me, it's more important that you get some type of pressure rolling in the earlier turns so that they can't use their resources efficiently and they can't just take too much damage. So getting the pressure game plan means that you go like one drop Hyena, Animal Companion, Frenzy that, and then like every turn you're dealing a little bit more damage. And by the time they get to Dr. Boom, either they can't survive your Zul'jin or you can kill them before fatigue ever even comes into play.
So there are two cards.
Against Mage, you're definitely the aggressor. But there's very fringe situations where you can play to a Zul'jin out, but very fringe.
So you think Cyclone Mage really is, that's in your favor, that matchup? I mean, you got the hero power.
Okay, people will argue with me about this. APX says it's Mage favored, but I guess I'm biased. I think it's Hunter favored. Not by a whole lot, but I just think that cards like Kill Command and your hero power and Scavenging Hyena, like, that, those are just on paper things that Mage will struggle to deal with.
Because, like, I mean, like, what really feels bad is, like, Sorcerer's Apprentice, Double Mirror, and then,
and
you know,
you need Mage. You need to have exactly Unleashed Timberwolf to deal with that. And, yeah, I mean, but you can make the same argument, right? If Mage gets the Nuts Hand, they're going to beat any class, right?
That's true.
So I'm talking about the average Mage draw, in which case your Hunter should be okay.
So there are two cards that, like, I know I question, like, when the right time to play them is. And so I know other people probably have the same question. And those are Master's Call and Dire Frenzy. Like, when is the right time to play Master's Call? And what are the right targets for Dire Frenzy in, like, what matchup?
You know, okay. So I could write a whole essay on this. Timing of Master's Call is just, like, basically, if you can play Companion and you're trying to pressure them, you play Companion over Master's Call. But if you have no good pressure play that turn, it's generally better to go for Master's Call just because it's one of the most powerful draw cards in Hearthstone right now. It might even be the most powerful outside of Stargazer. But timing of frenzy, if you're trying to be the aggressor, and this is not always just based on the matchup, it's based on your evaluation of the matchup. I can tell you it's more common to be the aggressor against mage, but there are situations where you might try to win off of Zul'jin. But you just frenzy any available target when you're trying to be the aggressor, because you're just jamming another 3 damage to their face. But ideally, the 1 drops are good targets. Springpaw and Timberwolf against mage are pretty good, just because they're cheap. You can go on 4 mana, Master's Call, draw one of the 4/4s and play it on that same turn. And importantly, you can pair them with Tundra Rhino for a lot of burst damage. So the 1 drops are good against mage. Against Balm Warrior, Scale Height is your number 1 frenzy target. Number 2 is probably Tundra Rhino. And against Control Warrior, Tundra Rhino, most likely. A lot of people try to go for like the Timberwolf OTK, but I think that's like, it's very rare when you end up going for that and it actually works. I just like frenzy aggressively. That's what I like to do. And against Shaman and Rogue, you want to frenzy either Springpaw or Scalehide most often, because they can rush, and rushing minions are great for controlling the board.
Okay. What do you think are the 2 flexible, most flexible cards in this list? Like, and what would you take them out to shore up your win rate versus another matchup, I guess?
The second copy of Unleash the Beast is probably not necessary. I was just facing a lot of Control Warriors. Good. And also the mirror, it's good in the mirror. But you can remove that, add another Headhunter's Hatchet. You can remove, I think, a Marked Shot maybe. Although I really like Marked Shot. Because you don't have cards in the 4-drop slot. So it's just good to spend your mana. The number 1 rule as mid-range hunter is spend all your mana. Okay. It seems like a dumb thing to say, but it's actually really important to take note of. You can add more anti-aggro tech, like another Hatchet. You can add Rat Trap versus Rogue. It's also semi-decent against mage. But generally, you would rather develop a minion than play a Rat Trap on turn 2. I've seen people removing Scavenging Hyena, but I think that's just wrong. I think the card's insane. Even in the matchups where you think it would not be doing that well, like Rogue, later on, sometimes you can find a turn to just double trade Spring Paws and play Hyena, and it's just, you know, relatively large, still better. And I just think that removing your only playable minion on turn 2 for 2 mana is bad for matchups like Mage and Warrior, because it helps so much. What else can you cut? I've seen people removing a Deadly Shot, but I think that the card's just good. So much Mage right now.
Yeah.
And aside from Mage, you can also Deadly Shot to deal with stealth minions like Spirit of the Frog, Spirit of the Shark, Edwin. So
in terms of mulligans, are there some cards that you always hold in the mulligan? And are there also cards Master's Call, you always hold that.
Yeah. I've thought about throwing it against Mage, for example, if you're on the play and you have nothing else. Because it's really important to go 1-drop, 2-drop, and hopefully companion in that matchup. But Master's Call is just so good on average that I don't think I'm ever tossing it in any matchup these days. On the coin, you never, ever, ever toss it. On the play, there's maybe a 5% chance you toss it. I don't know. I'm not sure if it's completely correct, but that's what I've been doing. I keep Springpaw against all the aggressive matchups. I keep Shimmerfly, I think, basically every matchup too, because it's the best thing you can do on turn 1.
Yeah.
And against Rogue, I like to keep Scalehide. It's also decent against Shaman, just because the 1-3 stat line with Rush is very convenient for dealing with their stuff. And I keep Companion almost every matchup too.
Do you ever keep a ridiculously slow card like Zul'jin for a certain matchup? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You definitely keep it against Control Warrior. I also keep it against Balm Warrior. It's not always worked out, but basically I only keep it against Warriors. Like, you can keep it in the Hunter Mirror too, but on Ladder, there's a lot of Mech Hunter too, and Zul'jin is not great. So since I won't know what type of Hunter it is, I throw Zul'jin when I see a Hunter.
So, you know, that's one deck that we didn't really talk about earlier, is Mech Hunter. Do you feel that mid-range Hunter What is the matchup like versus those two decks? Who do you think is favored?
I think whoever's on the play is favored.
Really?
I hate to oversimplify it, but like this is one matchup where you being on the coin is not that great, because against Mech Hunter, if you just clear their board every turn, none of their stuff has charge. Mm-hmm. The deck's powerful at smorking because if one thing sticks, suddenly all your magnetics have charge, yeah. quote unquote. But if you get like a one drop into like Hyena / Scale Hide / Headhunter's Hatchet, you can deal with their Mecharoo, you can deal with their Galvanizer, and then you just get bored from there. Mm-hmm. But if they're going first and they play Mecharoo, and you don't want to go Spring Paw Coin Links into that, especially if you don't have a two drop, and then suddenly the magnetics can overrun you.
Yeah.
So I think the matchup's really close.
Wow. That's good insight. You know, like this is something I rarely think about, is how big the difference in like win rate is on or off the coin. I guess it is pretty significant now that I think about it, because like even if you were able to deal with the Mecharoo, like you're always being reactive to the board every turn, right? Like you have to keep it clear. So I mean, you're always playing behind. And then they drop the 3-2 where they put the two bombs. Right?
Well, like, sometimes if you have the weapon, that's a huge deal. And the other huge thing is Scavenging Hyena. It's really, really good in that matchup because they don't have single target removal until they can go like, I don't know, Spider Bomb. And that's not even guaranteed single target removal, or the poisonous guy. But yeah, it's generally fine. And also their big power combo of the Minimizer.
The missile launcher?
What's it called? Missile launcher.
Yeah.
You can deal that with a single deadly shot. Mm-hmm. So that is also a good thing for mid-range hunter. I'm sure the coin can be useful as well if you just get hatchet. And if they miss their one drop, you're...
That's true.
I might be biased though. And the good thing is that they play 2-1 drops, just 2 Mecharoo, and you play 6-1 drops. You play double Springpaw, double Shimmerfly, double Timberwolf. Even though Timberwolf doesn't feel good to play on turn one, it's perfectly fine against Mech Hunter turn one.
So in the aggressive matchups, you keep Timberwolf in the opening hand?
Not necessarily.
I mean, like...
I'd much rather have Springpaw. I wouldn't keep Timberwolf. But if I'm given Timberwolf off the mulligan and I'm on the play, I always play at turn one in the aggressive matchup.
All right. Are there any like decisions that seem counterintuitive with the deck that people playing it for the first time might make a mistake doing? Like
counterintuitive.
Like something that like I don't know. You'd be like, okay, yeah, I definitely this is turn five or whatever. I definitely want to play this, but in reality, it's like you should never do this or something.
There's a lot of, I guess, Hunter players that their first instinct is always smart with this deck. As long as you can play a minion, just always play a minion. But there are situations where it's better to draw with Master's Call, or it's better to hold minions, for example, against Warrior. In the early turns, it's very important that you don't play into their Dynomatics, even if it means you don't develop an Animal Companion that turn, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't want to give them their efficient removal.
Yeah.
And then in the mid-range Hunter Mirror, I also like to hold on to my minions sometimes. I don't play a Tundra Rhino just straight up to threaten lethal, because it's much better later on and it dies straight up to Unleash the Beast. And sometimes it can be better because you play a lot of removal cards. Well, in my list, you play double Deadly Shot, you play double Mark Shot. So sometimes it's better to take a step back and use your removal. Take the turn to respond to your opponent. And then when they run out of threats, that's when you go in with your threats.
Okay. Interesting. So, hey, before we get into an actual game, a co-op game, just want to thank you again for jumping on the show and, you know, talking about your experiences as both a player and a caster and as a female.
No worries.
Is there anything you want to say to people at home, like where they can follow you or follow your journey as a Hearthstone player?
Yeah, basically I'm only on Twitter. I'm not really good with the whole social media thing. My friends have been telling me to get an Instagram for like years now. But yeah, just Twitter at GAD_. I have not been streaming lately, but I plan to try again within the within this year at some point. So twitch.tv/Gia_HS. But don't hold your breath, because my setup is not good right now for streaming.
What are you missing for your setup? Like, that would take it to the next
internet.
Level.
Good internet. Yeah. I think I've been cutting out a lot during this podcast.
Sorry. It's not too bad. There's a couple times, but it's not like...
Okay, it's not unwatchable.
Oh, definitely.
But a stream on this internet would be pretty unwatchable, I think. So, yeah. There's that.
Awesome, awesome. So, yeah, we're going to just jump into the game. If you guys are listening to the audio version of this podcast, thank you for tuning in. You got to meet Gia. Great caster, great player, rank 1 mid-range hunter, right? And that's what the deck we were talking about today. We are going to play into a game on the YouTube channel. So if you're not following, make sure you follow on youtube.com/KinsanityHS, and you'll be able to catch the visual version as we get into like one or two games, probably one game of the co-op. Cool. So thank you so much for joining. And we're just going to jump into it. I don't know, Gia, I don't know if I have you on my friends list.
I'm not sure you do.